Welcome to this week's Podcast with a K, available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, and Audio Boo.
Greetings, ladies and gentlemen, you join us for another podcast with a K. I'm Christian Corley. I'm joined by my cohorts, my co-hosts, my men-at-arms, Brian Turnover and James McLean. Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening. Yes, because it's the evening.
Yeah, we're actually...
So good evening.
Yeah, we're recording in evening time on this occasion. I should be honest as well, if you hear me slurping, I've got an ice cream.
Nice.
I'm enjoying an ice lolly because we're having... ridiculously hot weather in the UK. Now, if you're in the southwest or along the south coast, it might not be that crazy for you, the temperature, or if you're in sort of Surrey, Hertfordshire, those sorts of places, it's kind of par for the course at this time of year. In my neck of the woods, it's like being on holiday. It's really, really weird. Because, you know, we're on the North Sea coast. We have this vortex effect in the North Sea with winds and what have you. It's quite unseasonable, despite it being summer. So, yeah, I'm enjoying a Solero.
So we can categorise this one as science fiction, or we can put it in the category of meteorological reports.
Most definitely, yeah.
Meteorological, yes, absolutely.
Indeed, I was on the radio earlier, and you know, there's people flocking to Redcar Beach. I mean, people haven't done that since the 60s. It's weird, very strange. So, sorry, were we going to do a commentary?
I thought you were already doing one.
A Doctor Who commentary.
Oh, one of those, yeah.
Now, we had a kind of the previous few we've done, we've kind of picked them at random, haven't we? But we do actually have a rationale for this week's commentary, don't we?
I don't know, do we?
We do! Because we've done two McCoys, haven't we?
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not doing it because... The one we've chosen is Rose, and that's because there are some similarities between... Although you couldn't really see them at the time, but looking back, there are similarities between Rose and what Russell T Davies kick-started, and some of the things that were going on in the McCoy era with Ace.
Yes, I could see that at the time. Thank you for speaking for me on that.
Could you, though? Could you see that?
I could, actually. And if you want me to go and sort of search through the Gallifrey Brace archives, I'm sure I could find evidence of me at the time saying how this feels like a pickup of Survival.
God, no, don't.
No, God, no. Please don't make me.
Okay. Right, so we're all ready to play Rose. James and I are using Netflix. Brian's using the DVD.
Because they took it away from us on Netflix, Christian. They took it away in America.
Okay. I've just hit the vortex. I think James is the same.
Yep.
Yeah. I'm here too.
So we're going to do a countdown from five?
Sure.
Okay. So if you want to join us with this podcast, dear... Listener,
with this countdown.
I know.
Yeah. If you want to join us, children.
We're going to start from five, then down to four. excuse me. So, yeah, if you want to join us with the DVD, it's the best way to enjoy one of our commentaries, if enjoy is the operative word.
Even if we're not doing a DVD commentary, probably the best way to enjoy them is to stick a commentary on and listen to that instead. Turn us down.
Indeed. So, we're going to count down now. If you've got your DVD loaded up, and five... 4, 3, 2, 1. Well, mine's playing.
I remember hearing this music for the first time when they played on the radio before the series aired, and I was positively surprised in a positive way that it was actually a good rendition of the theme tune. I was just not expecting anything fresh.
Right.
I thought it'd just feel like another done by electronic, slightly synthed thing or like, stringed thing. But like this had a bombastic
thing. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. But you know, you're right, it is good. I always loved the leaked version had the Tom Baker theme tune on top of the titles. And I thought that was fantastic.
Didn't it also have a bit of like sped up titles as well to match the music?
Yes, I think they were. I always remember this as being before the titles, because this, I think the reason for it is that this was shown on New Year's Day at like 8 o'clock or whatever, before something important for New Year's Day's television schedule in 2005 was aired. So I always remember that zoom in, and then it says, you know, it's time or whatever it says. Coming before Rose
Starling. I remember those trailers.
I find it was interesting, again, on a musical front, that the music made for Rose was a totally different feel to how he moved on to the series after this. I mean, this track is quite enjoyable, but it's utterly different to the way the...
A lot of people didn't actually even like this, and I remember really enjoying the music in this episode, aside from some of the volume issues.
And it's diegetic as well. It was playing in the store.
Yeah,
it's great.
And this is another turnaround, isn't it? In this episode, you get the suggestion that Mickey's a bit of a player.
Yeah.
And then as it goes along, he becomes the victim almost to the shenanigans.
I think I've been in that shop. Because I believe it was in Cardiff. And
I believe it was.
We went in there last time Kerry and I went to Cardiff. And I didn't realise it.
Did you find this still, I mean, we're going back to this whole idea of the McCoy. This still didn't feel like McCoy in the sense this did feel very new. And I remember watching this feeling quite uncertain what I was going to get.
Yeah, I never got any McCoy era vibes from this at all at the time.
I got them in some respects, in the sort of, if you're looking at the sort of a structural thing, but in actual sort of, as you say, the aesthetics, the sort of sound, the music, all the bits and pieces.
I don't know about the McCoy touches yet, because I mean, I know it's more like in character kind of, and a little bit in tone, but I'm a little bit surprised I'd forgotten how quickly we had gotten to the Altons in this story.
We get a potted day, don't we? And then it drops, shows us who Rose is, where she lives, what she does, and throws us straight into the action.
But it doesn't tell us or give us any indication who Wilson is. And at this point, I was very intrigued about this Wilson character. I even predicted that he'd be a major part of the arc, but no. I'd like to see them come back and find out.
He's just a basketball with a bloody face, with a bloody handprint on him.
I think he's the door. She's talking to that door. It might be named. Maybe a good Auton, a good metal Auton. Because they're all shocked and horrified that Autons could be plastic, but metal ones are everywhere in this universe. And that's fine. That's you know, laws of physics and everything. You can have metal Autons, but plastic, good God forbid. I've forgotten how long this was, this tension build-up thing.
Certainly does it.
And there's a lot of sort of slightly arbitrary devices here, aren't there? Like the door closing and locking. Are we to assume that an Auton's done that? You know, a piece of plastic wire shut it?
Presumably.
I had always just assumed, yeah.
Oh, Wilson.
But given that there's a whole load of Autons in there with guns, you wouldn't think they would need to. It's obviously there to for sort of an attention, you know, attention thing.
I think it was Wilson. I think Wilson had been replaced by the Autons, like Channing in Spearhead from Space.
I don't think he was hired. I think he just got fed up with her shouting through his door.
Every Saturday. Yeah, with a lottery money.
I do remember being really impressed with this, though, that rather than just being like a head with a scarf around the neck so you couldn't see somebody was wearing a mask, they made an entire mask, neck and chest unit, which was just great.
Yeah, I know. I never really noticed that, though, strangely.
Oh, no?
No.
I never noticed right there in that last shot we saw that you could see the seam down the back of this guy's head.
Ah.
Thought they would have blurred that out with some digital effect, but no.
I never liked these Autons particularly. I still prefer the Spearhead from Space ones. Oh.
There he is. I was thrilled that Christopher Eccleston was cast as a Doctor, I have to say.
I wasn't so sure.
Yeah, I'm with James there.
I liked him when I
didn't know him.
But when I saw him in this, I wasn't sure if I believed him.
Right.
I didn't. He wasn't the doctor to me until Dalek.
Yeah.
Whatever it was with that particular episode, I sat there and I said, okay, yes, this man is the doctor. But it took me 6 episodes to feel that way.
It took me 6 and a bit. The moment in the long game, when she says trouble and he goes, oh yes, that's what sealed it for me.
Well, it's weird too, because you think about it, somebody watching this new for the first time, he's just the doctor for them, yeah, you know, yeah. And like for us, we have a history. We know what he has been like, and it's so weird to think that through 8 different lives of him, that this one could feel off to us until a couple episodes in, we start to realize it's him, you know. And it makes me wonder how many times we do that for a new doctor anyway.
I think we do, yeah. I think with him, it was perhaps less to do with how he was portraying the doctor. Perhaps it was knowing Christopher Eccleston for his more serious roles, and suddenly seeing him playing something so eccentric was difficult to reconcile.
See, I didn't even know him before.
Exactly.
This is the first time I've seen him in anything, and I liked him, but I think like there was a couple of different things. I mean, I am one of those guys that was like a buzz cut and a leather jacket just didn't seem doctorish to me, you know. And then him walking around acting the way he acted, it still seemed off to me and just wasn't working. And then it was just like, it took a little while to get used to the idea that, wait a minute, the doctor changes face and personality and costumes all the time. Why can't this easily be one of them? And I don't know. Like I said, Dalek somehow just made me do a complete flip-flop, and I was sold. And now I watch these, and I love the guy.
Yeah.
You know, but when I first watched them, I was like, this episode's good. I want to see more, but I'm not sure about this doctor yet, you know?
As props go, that bomb, has anyone ever done a replica of that bomb device of his?
I don't know how accurate anybody's ever gotten with it, but I think I saw, like, a doctor or two, like, carry some base kind of looking bombs like that at conventions.
It always looks like a graphics card to me.
Does it? Yeah.
It does, yeah.
I actually have a photo of it from one of the Doctor Who exhibits when I was in England. One of those times I went to the exhibits that they had it on display. I think it was in the Liverpool exhibit. It was on display there. So I have a photo, but I wonder like if how accurately you want to actually replicate that bomb for anywhere other than your own home collection, you know. Might not be able to be walking the streets with that.
Camille Kadjuri's dialogue in this scene's excellent, I think.
I remember having to ask you, Christian, it was you or Anthony, but I think it was you, when Mickey comes in and she says, oh, and there's himself. And it was like all the British TV and other dramas I had watched, I'd never heard that expression. I was like, she does mean Mickey when she says that, right? But that's just an expression that you guys use. There's nothing behind that, because I had never heard it before.
I think it's quite colloquial. It's not something we use up here that often.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
But I mean, that scene, you know exactly who and what Jackie is just from a few lines on the phone. It's fantastic. Yeah.
Well, that's what's great about this whole episode so far. You got it. You got an entire taste of Rose's day through an entire sped up montage. Her relationship with her boyfriend in that time, and now her mom in such a short time span. We're about 9 minutes into the episode. We've already been introduced to the doctor and the Autons. Like, it's amazing how much they can tell you without having to force feed it on you.
Yeah.
You know, it was very subtle. I mean, it was a quickly done intro, but it's very subtle. It's all natural so far, and that's really great. It's a great way to introduce a character. Great storytelling so far.
It's exactly what the 8th Doctor's one should have done.
Although he's got the wrong arm there, by the way. Ah.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know why, but for every other shot, it was a right hand, and then there it's a left hand.
I'm sorry, I'm a very literal person. Why is there an alarm clock in that barrel? And it's the same alarm clock as Rose has got. Isn't that freaky?
It's uncanny.
Is Wilson dead then?
Yeah, I think so.
I hate to go back to Wilson, but
he's certainly,
you know,
been deflated.
Well, I don't know. I keep hoping for the Wilson spin-off series. You know, maybe it'll come after Ass, Class.
Ass?
What?
Nothing.
But yeah, the dialogue is very strong. And as you say, the structure works very well.
Is that a hairdryer? Oh, my God.
I think so.
I was right. Is that what she does for a job or something?
I presume so. I don't know. Does she do Elton's hair in Love and Monsters at any point?
Do you not recall?
No.
I like this set as well. There's some nice little little bits I like the unpapered wall to the right there.
Who has a key on their door hanging like that?
I think it's a chain, isn't it?
No, there's a key on it.
No, is it?
Yep, don't look too closely behind him.
No, I'll try not to. Yeah.
Come on, keep focusing on him. Focus on him.
Yeah.
Don't look behind. No. That's it. Close the door. Close the door. There we go.
And do you know what, though? I would take that any day over a green screen CGI.
Yeah, me too.
Good for you.
No one will ever know.
I would. I would, because I think it looks good. Well, over basic green screen CGI, good green screen CGI, you shouldn't be able to tell, but some of them you can tell and they're just horrible.
But I also, I mean, I'm used to it, because I mean, like Stones of Blood in the cottage, there was that same issue with the windows and the door and the bad backdrop, and it'd be like, yeah, close the windows, close the curtains, please. But yeah, I think something was nice about, because this was something that you could do now, which you couldn't really, didn't seem able to do in the 90s or the 80s, is that you can sort of have that sort of product placement, which is annoying, it's product placement, but it is relevant because it makes it feel real, like you've got Heat magazine there. Mm. You have, oh, there we go, that one line that has caused much arguments over fandom.
Yes.
When did he just regenerate? Is this just after...
If he didn't just regenerate, it's kind of odd that he's never looked in a mirror before.
He might have been too busy to pass to look at a mirror, though.
Yeah. Now, was that actually product placement, though? I thought the BBC wasn't allowed to do product placement.
Well, Heat magazine exists, so...
Yeah, but is that, like...
Yellow Pages. I mean, the fact... I didn't mean legally it was. I'm just saying that, you know, there's that you wouldn't in the old... I don't think you would see anything in the old... show. I can't remember anything that springs to mind. Might have been a Daily Mirror or something at one point. But by and large,
Action
you didn't
Man
see brands.
They might have been advertising eye patches at one point. Hmm. Oh my god, the Action Man tank, yes.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
hilarious.
Yeah. I always, you know, there's a publicity still of Christopher Eccleston doing the card thing. And shot never appears in the show.
Hmm.
Which is very
has he got a really, really weak arm?
Yeah, he must have, wasn't he? Yeah. Or they're really heavy plastic.
So you both see this as a post-Day of the Doctor regeneration thing as well?
I mean, I do, yeah.
Because, I mean, they said at the time that was never really thought about.
Yeah, the main reason that I do is because there's two reasons. One, I mean, it just seems silly that he's never looked in a mirror before. And two, at the end of the episode, spoiler for everyone who hasn't seen this episode with us before, when he comes back to... No, not even the end of the episode, excuse me. When Rose goes to Clive and that has that whole archive of like the things the Doctor has done, I just think it's a cooler idea as a time travel show to think that all of those pictures Rose is looking at, she was there with the Doctor. You know,
not,
like she'll go live those adventures with him. She's not in any of the photos, but she could be there. Or the other alternative, of course, is when the Doctor leaves her at the end of the episode, he goes off, does all those things, and then thinks to himself, oh, did I tell her it was a time machine? And pops back to tell her it was a time machine.
I like those aspects of it rather than the idea that he just hasn't looked in a mirror, that he's done everything beforehand, that he's been wandering around tidying up after the Time War. And then he comes in.
That just seems weird to me, because you would think, especially if he had done all those things with the Titanic and so on prior to this episode, the way that, you know, Clive's conspiracy theory is trying to suggest, he would have seen himself. You know, it just seems weird to me. I mean, everybody can believe what they want to believe, but it just seems weird to me that he's never looked at himself before.
I mean the two points there. One is that we know that he always narcissistically checks himself after regeneration. That seems to be a common thing for him to do.
Yeah.
So that is one factor. And the second factor, if anyone is worried about giving away spoilers at the end of this episode, right?
I was joking.
I will just let you know that she is Bad Wolf. He regenerates at the end of this episode. The next series is with David Tennant as the Doctor. Rose leaves at the end of that, trapped between two dimensions, and she comes back later in
the series.
Of
course, not the end of the episode.
I just think that, you know.
I was only kidding about the spoilers, James. I felt the same way.
I know you were. Do you imagine that's the War Doctor's jacket? Is it close enough, Brian?
God, no. No, not the War Doctor's jacket, no. They're not close enough. They're not similar at all, actually.
But it's weird, because that is almost suggestion, isn't it?
Is it?
Well, I always got that sort of feeling, the way that they did it, that the War Doctor sort of had a very similar sort of a leather jacket, worn jacket approach, that there was a suggestion that it carried on. For someone like me who's not really looked closely at the jackets, that was my feeling or idea.
No. The War Doctor's jacket was brown. His is black. You know, they're a different design, different shape. He's not wearing any of the War Doctor's other clothing. I assume he's always changed. I'll tell you what I didn't like. Doctor Who magazine, when they did that Eighth Doctor comic strip where the Eighth Doctor regenerated into the Ninth Doctor, they had him sitting there, or he was going to regenerate. I think they canceled on that. And then instead of having him regenerate, they had him say, hey, you know what, maybe I'll get a leather jacket. You know, and then the Big Finish audios now have switched over to the Eighth Doctor wearing a leather jacket, because it's a natural progression. Like, why would Christopher Eccleston choose a leather jacket after regenerating from the Eighth Doctor, unless his previous self was wearing one too? And then, of course, Moffat did the same thing with the War Doctor, where I just don't buy that. I think that's the dumbest excuse. Like, every Doctor has chosen their wardrobe based on who they are now, not who they were. You know, so like that whole aspect of needing the Doctor prior to Eccleston wearing a leather jacket in order for Eccleston to be the one to choose a leather jacket for himself just doesn't make sense. But no, I don't think they're meant to be the same leather jacket. I think the suggestion was that he has worn one before, and they're trying to like put that hint out there that like, oh, this isn't for Eccleston. It wasn't new, even though obviously he was the first one we ever saw wearing a leather jacket.
I think it's probably worth mentioning how much of a surprise Billy Piper was. As Rose.
Yes.
Not just the casting,
good
but
surprise
how good she
as
was.
Well.
Yeah. Yes. She's another one I did not know of, but knowing of her background, I was curious of her acting. Just because, you know, I'm one of those people that always thinks, you know, when people say that a musician or can't act and an actor can't sing kind of thing, I always say, you know, these are just talented people. They can do anything they put their minds to. So, but I didn't know what to expect. You know, you never know, especially when it's somebody's supposed first acting job or something. But she was really good.
Yeah, I think she did something before this with Dennis Waterman or someone like that on BBC Two. But yeah, this was her first series, and yeah, she's fantastic. And I think we've talked about the difference between Series One Rose and Series Two and later Rose. I always prefer Series One Rose. She's,
I agree.
Yes.
Far more companion material.
And this, you know, we should also talk about this, the tie-in websites. You could actually, at the time this episode aired, you could go to that website.
Yeah.
Like, people watching the show now for the first time will not have that experience, because most of those websites are shut down.
Yeah. There was a Unit one as well, wasn't there?
Yes. Yeah.
And a Bad Wolf one as well, I think?
Was there a Bad Wolf one?
Sure.
I don't remember.
Clive is played by Mark Benton, who was is a local of this area.
Well, yes, when you say as a local, you are only speaking for
my neck of the woods, the northeast.
So, so technically speaking, he is distinctly unlocal to the majority of us here. But then so are most people.
You can see the similarity in our accents, can't you?
I think when we talked about the whole thing with the McCoy connection, apart from the fact, obviously, as you say, there is this focus on the companion, which is moving on. I mean, obviously, I would say it's got stronger ties to the New Adventures.
Oh, wait, look at this. There's a rose on that door. I've never noticed that before.
Yeah.
Sorry to cut you off, James, but that was an in-the-moment thing I had to do there.
And on the lamp.
But go on.
As well.
I think that where the sort of very strong feeling connection I had when I watched it was with Survival, I could sort of picture this following on from Survival,
yes.
The sort of tone and the way that it tries to realise urban British society, urban life. Which Survival perhaps doesn't do a brilliant job, but it tries to have the youth centre, you know, the streets, the urban boringness. And this sort of tries to do something similar. It sort of tries to sort of create a feel of reality that the Doctor's in. So I think in that sort of sense, it feels like a straight bridge from the old series. But I think structurally, it feels more like what was going on with the New Adventures, where they were going. These were terrible. I couldn't believe when I watched it. I mean, his face,
it's very bad photoshopping.
Bad photoshop, especially at the time where there's no excuse for that. Mm. But yeah. I mean, I think what is quite interesting here, and something the later series don't really do, is that I suppose the later series, when they talk about historically looking for the Doctor, they always look for the TARDIS. But here is that logical assumption that if you find a Doctor who a person who looked the same, that would be the only Doctor. You know, you don't look and sort of say, well, this Doctor appears in many different costumes and looks and styles, always along with a police box. Here it sort of makes that suggestion logically. But that's terrible as well. God. Yeah, that's a real bad montage. Yeah, I found that odd as well. Again, that's a New Adventures throw out death.
Yeah.
That feel very. Oh, we're coming up to that scene, which was probably the most contentious one when this first aired, and probably still is.
Ah, yes.
Yes.
I'd forgotten about this actually. Oh dear. I wonder if he's got records of all the other Doctors, as well as the Ninth Doctor.
I don't know. Sorry, we went quiet now, and that's one of the things you do in commentary, you can't go quiet. You can't get sucked into the worst moment of the episode.
Yeah, Brian.
What I loved about this, in a sense, was the sort of Britishness of it, but it was very much, you know, these nice suburban streets. Although this odd room doesn't feel very real.
Or safe. This bit here, this bit's clever, but what happens afterwards is...
Yeah, the stretching plastic stuck to his hands is quite a horrid thing for kids, but then it gets a little too... CG too silly. And I think we always have to say, isn't it, that they were still finding their way at this point. That's very evident.
Yeah.
I mean, Noel Clarke is overhamming his character far too much in this first couple of episodes.
Do you think?
Yeah, I think this here is he's overplaying it. And he overplays that pratfall at the end of this episode. No. Yeah, it's the end of, I can't remember which episode it is, where he runs into the wall.
I think it's this one. No, it's not. It's speaking of
Aliens of London.
It's Aliens of London, yeah.
And it's still a little too silly, which you wouldn't see them really doing after that. And again, this here, the tone is wrong. I mean, this is a sort of, I mean, to be honest, this is more Sarah Jane Adventures, isn't it? This reference.
Yes, it is, yeah. She should really have noticed that wasn't Mickey, shouldn't she? Really?
Exactly. I think that's where it sort of becomes a little hard.
He looks like an action man.
I suppose you'd have to argue you would have no idea that could be done, so you'd assume that he was feeling ill or... But if she didn't think he was an auto, which she should at least be concerned he's acting with.
That's right.
This doesn't quite... Yeah, it's just too childish. Too Sarah Jane Adventures. Still fun, but it doesn't fit with what comes. But I suppose that's what makes this interesting, isn't it? Is that you get a feeling of a production which is trying something which no one knows how it's going to sit because it's doing something which hasn't actually been tried for, you know, what, 15 years? And even then it wasn't doing very well. So actually introducing the family audience again is a... family audience show is a scary thing, and you can just tell they don't know how to pitch it at the moment. Do they go young? Do they go for the older people be interested? And at this point you get the feeling that they've decided, yeah, this is going to be aimed at kids will like this, we're not sure about adults, so let's make this lighter than darker.
There he is. It's been a good 10 minutes without the Doctor.
Yeah,
which is quite unusual for Doctor Who.
And yet at the same time, all the scripts will have been, you know, done with this. So it's just a matter of how you produce the actual episode.
It's the execution, isn't it, I think?
Exactly, because you could do this, and it could be, it could feel as dark as Empty Child or Long Game, if you wanted it to. Or sort of Long Game being a middle ground. But as you say, as soon as you have the music on, the little comments, the sound effects, you change that feel enough. At this moment, you can tell they're just not quite sure who they're aiming to show.
Yeah.
I think the music as well is perhaps another example of that. Music is over the top. It's
a bit Sarah Jane feeling, I guess.
Yeah. We just said that, how this is very Sarah Jane.
Yeah.
There's no subtlety to it.
I love this shot right here, the TARDIS.
That's not a bad shot. That's a nice.
Yeah, I love when you can get. We always get this shot, you know. So when you get an overhead shot of the box, it's always a great look. Although you can see they don't have the post caps in there.
Yeah.
But this is the. I mean, they made changes to this box fairly soon on, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, the, I mean, all throughout its life.
The side panels, the square windows.
It's a good moment. This they.
Yes.
They seem to have been very afraid of redoing this moment in Doctor Who since.
Well, you don't want to replicate the moment.
You don't. I know, but at the same time, you don't want to. You don't want to. You know, they replicate everything else. I'm gonna go at doing this again. I. Oh,
yeah, I think the only other time that they had a really good moment like this. Or at least another in the new series, another cool companion moment about the room size. Well, I guess there were two. I liked Martha. I liked when the Doctor kind of mimicked what Martha was saying behind her back, like her surprise. He was mimicking her surprise. But I liked Rory's response as well. I'll give Moffat that, because Rory totally was trying to act cool, like this didn't faze him, kind of thing, you know. But otherwise, it does seem kind of weird when other companions just come in and like, oh, this is your ship, cool, rather than like, oh, it's like freaking out like her, like. If we all walked into this box, which was just a little blue box, and it was this big, we would all freak out. Like, how the hell did you?
I think
do
you're
that?
Right. They're misreading why you need that moment. It's not because it's a moment to tell the audience. It's because the audience like to experience that moment of seeing through that person's eyes the TARDIS for the first time. And as soon as you cut that down and sort of have them go, "Oh, it's smaller on the outside," it sort of takes away that moment, that thrill.
Yeah, that should be on the Chibnall to-do list, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, no, Mickey's melted.
I also like that when she first stepped in the box, they didn't let us see what she was seeing. We just saw her freaking out about it. So it was even another way to build up more anticipation, for like, especially for new viewers. Like, what the heck could be in there that gave her that reaction?
Yeah, absolutely.
They're doing a lot of interesting angles in these first few moments of this box, and not to say that they don't do it later, but I'm used to it later on, just a lot more of the basic angles of that room, you know, an over the head shot or just two shot kind of thing, like no real interesting like it's almost like instead of being an introduction to the set where you'd think they would show the whole thing as massive as can be, it's like they've already been shooting on this set for years and they want to try and make it interesting again with those new angles, but instead they started off the bat with those new angles.
Mm.
Well, Keith Bogue, the director, he only did this in, was it Aliens of London? And then that was double banked with this, wasn't it? So they did both stories at the same time. And then he never worked on the show again.
Shame.
He was...
I love that exchange with the all right stuff.
Yeah.
I love that, like, how he just plays off that. And she's like, all right. And he's like, yes, it is. I've always loved that moment.
I always like that line that they have where he says, where he explains the TARDIS. It disappears here, and it reappears here or something. Yes. It's a really nice simplification that you just need to give your new audience. Just give them the basics. And I think that's what's beautiful about his writing is that it's very carefully... deconstructs what Doctor Who is into what is to be what is needed to be known at the given time.
Yeah.
And you don't need to know that it travels through time yet. I mean, you've had hints about it and you've had some sort of references, but you don't need to specifically be focused on it. The thing at the moment you need to know is that it disappears from there and it reappears here.
Yeah. Well, and the, in no way does this episode feel like an info dump. You know, it's coming after 26 years of history for this show. You know, 26 plus with a TV movie, we'll just say television history, And it's not feeling like an info dump at all. They're doing it as if this is a brand new show. And they're just feeding you information slowly the way a brand new show would. It's done really well. I've been on one of the Sisters of the Eye, but I have not been on the London Eye.
Oh, I've been on it.
Have I? No, I haven't. I've been on the York Eye. We sound too close to Yorkie, which was produced in York. Until Roundtree's were purchased by Nestle in the late 80s, early 90s.
I got added to a student party, a party of students who I was going out with one of the students, and they added me, so I got on to go onto the Eye for free.
Oh, lovely.
Oh, nice.
The one in York, which I believe has been in two other places around the UK, is very drafty, which I understand the London Eye isn't drafty.
No, it was quite airtight, if I remember rightly.
Yeah. And I've been on the York one a couple of times. I think my sister-in-law came on with us on one occasion, and she felt quite unwell afterwards. Nice bit of external set dressing, this, I think, that little doorway that he opens up. There's so many things happening underground in London, isn't there, alongside the railways. You've got secret MI5 bases, and you've got, in the Bond series, and you've got this Auton base, home
yes.
of the nesting consciousness.
Yeah, this is a nice.
And then you've got the business in... although I suppose it could be the same place, I suppose, in the Runaway Bride as well. That's under the...
I was just thinking that because it's the same area, isn't it? It's the yeah. same location. Whether this lot died out, and as soon as he leaves the area, this sort of spidery thing wanders past. And,
yeah. Oh, yeah.
this looks pretty good. well used. Oh, the Shadow Proclamation. I mean, I'd like to believe that there is an episode between Dare the Doctor and this, one which has the Doctor taken out of his comfort zone. Maybe he finds a sweater and a jacket in it, and, you know, does a small adventure which leads him to deal with the Autons or be concerned about the Autons, which then bridges to this. Because it feels like there probably is something between this and... Definitely.
It makes sense that there has to be something. I mean, especially when you just look at the Day of the Doctor, the fact that the War Doctor has his own TARDIS console room, you know, that's the one thing that really bugged me about the Day of the Doctor, that Moffat went that direction with the TARDIS console room, because you have the brilliant thought that they put into the console room that the Ninth Doctor starts with, is that it's supposed to be a time machine that has been traveling through space through 900 years, and he's fixed it with all those various bits and bobs on there, those crazy elements, you know. And then when you get Matt Smith's first new TARDIS console room, the TARDIS just reconstructed itself using those odd bits and bobs. And I guess that's what we're supposed to think happened for Eccleston as well. But it's a shame, because it was such a brilliant idea before that, you know, having no Gallifrey after the Time War, having no home, he's just been fixing this thing by himself using bits from Earth and other planets. And that's kind of gone now with what they did in the Day of the Doctor. If they had just let the War Doctor use the same console room, that element would have still been in place. That's the only thing that they really needed to do. But otherwise, now you have to have some kind of adventure in between to explain why he changes, why he has a different console room, and why he feels he's on this journey to track down the last steps of the Time War.
Nice. I think that's the one thing I like about Day of the Doctor, is it does give this sort of moment a little more, I don't know, it gives you a little more understanding or more to digest out of it. How the Ninth Doctor is a sort of repeal against the actions he had to do. Yeah. Again, the Auton attack, I preferred in Spearhead from Space. And that's not out of some sort of traditional classic, you know, one is better than the other. I just think it was stylistically stronger.
One of the interesting things about 21st Century Doctor is, and we've talked about this before on every podcast going, has talked about this, surely, is how the Companion has been transformed from a sort of cypher-esque maiden in distress into sort of an empowered woman. But that doesn't mean that we don't have maidens in distress in Doctor Who. For most of the Russell T Davies era, it was Jackie Tyler getting herself into pickles with aliens.
Yeah. Which is maybe a little bit of ageism there, you know.
Possibly.
Older people can still be in distress and needing the help of the young, smart, TV watchers. I don't know. It's I think the problem. I think the problem is the Autons here aren't too bad, but they're obviously there's a slight sort of curtailing of their threat.
I do remember thinking that Clive shouldn't have died there because I thought he would have made an interesting character throughout series one with this whole conspiracy of the Doctor. They could have gone someplace with that. Especially since they had Mickey take over the website not in the show, but in the website universe for the tie-ins, it would have been interesting to actually see Mickey with Clive in the show if they hadn't killed Clive.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. He was a little on the button for me. But nicely lit police box. Actually looks blue there. I must admit, aside from that bit in the we were talking about where it looked quite good, those earlier shots of it when you first see the police box and then later when it's sitting out while he does his speech about the world going round, it looks really shoddy, badly erected, just dumped in a spot.
I see what you're saying. I mean, I want to comment more so on the fact that you said it looked real blue there. The box is actually very blue. It just has to do with the lighting. It's got a lot of dark wash on it, but it's got a very nice blue to it that really does kind of shine. I really like the weathering on this box a lot. But, I mean, it was a pale blue they started with, so to get to this kind of bolder blue is surprising, even though it generally looks a bit more, I don't know, blue-gray-black when it's not got heavy lighting on it like this. But it does look really nice in this shot, you're right.
I mean, it's an interesting episode as well, as we've said before. I think that, you know, the main A plot is the B plot. The attack of the Autons is secondary to everything else, which is obviously going on. You know, the focus is who is this Doctor character.
Yeah.
And in a sense, I would have liked to have seen, obviously, how do I put it? I would like to have seen the Auton invasion done as a bigger thing, but they did it the right way around, doing it the way they did.
Yeah. I think, okay, this show for me started doing invasions too big. And that's kind of okay. They were trying to give a world where we started to actually become aware of aliens in our modern times. But I have to admit, like, a part of me was real sad at that, because one of the things I always loved about the old Doctor Who was unlike other science fiction shows, maybe outside the X-Files, the alien invasions or the alien threats to our Earth were always known by just a small group of people. Yeah. You know, otherwise the Earth just went on every day not knowing that alien threats were ever happening. Whereas this show, this version of the show, changed that. But I really liked that about this episode. Like, who knew about this? Like, everybody who saw the mannequins attacking, nobody knew it was aliens. Everybody were stumped by it, and they just went on about their daily life after it.
What do you think anti-plastic is?
I think it's a vial of blue food coloring.
I like to think
and
it's,
water.
Yeah, I like to think it's in world. I like to think it would have some sort of solidifying effect on the nesting conscious or something like that. But much like pouring some silica or gelatine into someone's drink and watching it just set.
That's okay. That's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way. I originally thought it was more of like a kind of like a plastic eating.
Right.
Kind of thing, like it would dissolve the plastic. But I like yours, because if it solidifies it, it kind of, I mean, especially if you think of the nesting consciousness as a brain and it solidifies it, how can it get any of its electrical impulses to work to think? That's pretty clever. I like that.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely.
I never considered it, which I think is one of the key reasons why people say, oh, well, Doctor Who's not about science in Russell T. Davies' era. But, you know, that's the beautiful thing is that I didn't care. It was just anti-plastic.
This, I mean, this is one of those bad Mickey moments, isn't it? I think.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
Where he's like stunned, drooling, and unable to talk and move properly.
It was poor treatment, poor character treatment.
Yeah, I'm not blaming.
There are better ways to play this.
I mean, Noel Clark said that he's not happy with it, but you know, it can't be entirely down to him. There's a director involved, after all.
Yeah. But it's also in the script that way. It's just kind of a poorly scripted moment. Like, there are other ways to get him to stay behind, you know, and still show that the character is afraid of what's going on without, like, resorting to a child TV show kind of character is afraid kind of element. I don't think Billy did anything bad in this episode. I think her entire performance throughout this whole episode has been brilliant going through it all right now. And I know we mentioned that her acting in series one was better, but I mean, she's really solid in this whole story.
I think Eccleston's playing it too sad there. I think this is the other thing. It seems like he's been on his own for a very, very long time as well, which makes me think this stuff that took place before.
Well, that to me is the War Doctor. I mean, I don't picture the War Doctor ever had a companion.
Well,
you know,
he does
I think
it,
that was
he does
I think
the novels.
He,
so,
yeah,
well, that which is, I'll put it to you this way: the novels, the audios, everything to me, none of them actually count. No matter how much they want to say they count, they don't count because the average Joe, average person watching this show should not need to know that the War Doctor had a companion in a book in order to understand the War Doctor's story. So we can only go by what the TV show tells us. And but what it appears to be is that he's been alone throughout the war. And that was the whole point, too. Even with if you give the War Doctor a companion, if Moffat lets that happen, if Moff brings that into his show, then you do ruin Russell's entire vision of this completely, which Moffat's already done to most of Doctor Who history anyway.
Couldn't you argue that because you don't need to know that the Autons invaded Earth, you know, in spearhead from space, that didn't happen because, you know, the rationale of that logic doesn't really follow for me. I mean, just
what
because
do you mean?
If the mainstream doesn't need to know that the Doctor worked for UNIT when he dealt with the Autons previously, it doesn't have to be continuity. Does the actual mainstream knowledge really determine what is considered relevant and what isn't?
Yeah. The way film works, if your TV or your movie are giving you information...
Oh my God, that's a terrible logo cut out there. Sorry.
That is terrible. But your TV show or your movie need to tell you what you need to know to understand the story. If they rely on books or radio dramas or comic books or interviews or behind-the-scenes things to give you information that you must know, because remember, when they were doing books for tie-ins with Series 1, the main thing that they said was, they're tie-ins with the show, but you don't need them to understand what's going on to the show. And that's important, because most of your base viewers, the viewers that they're aiming this show at, which are not the three of us, they're all the new audiences that they were aiming the show at, trying to drag in new viewers to make this show a bigger success than it would be with just the people like the three of us watching it.
But what I'm saying,
you cannot rely on books to give them extra information.
But
you know, I'm not saying that information can't be accepted by fans. I'm saying that it should not be the one solid truth. Otherwise, put it in the show. Because someone just watching the show without the books, the audios, or the comics, they're never going to know that one solid truth because they only watch the show.
Surely you could argue that about episodes that were shown 50 years ago, that they should no longer be considered continuity because new audiences will have unlikely to have seen them. They're not necessary. We've moved on. If we want to say that the Doctor never had a granddaughter called Susan,
well,
we can do that
now. Here's my reply to that. They do not the past 26 years are not required viewing to understand the new series. They are proper continuity with the show, because Russell T. Davis even said that, like, the show continues on from that. But the main point of the new show was that you do not need to have seen the past 26 years to understand the show. If that's the case, you do not need the books either to understand this show.
Well, that's
so, yes,
that's
you don't need the past of the show, but the
I'm
past
asking,
of the show is the true continuity of
but
this
then
TV
so
series.
Is, but then so is the books and everything else, because they were official continuity. Like, as I've said before, the New Adventures were, officially continuity. So I'm not saying you need them, but I'm saying, can you actually devalue their relevance. I'm not saying that they need to be.
I think you have to. I understand that the BBC says that they're official continuity, but if they are official continuity, then you know, like, it, there's so much ridiculousness in the books and the radio dramas and everything. There's just complete nonsense that contradicts itself, and I know the show has done that as well. But you're expecting then new audiences to watch this show to then have gone and read those books to understand these little things that they're throwing in these stories.
That's necessarily true. I think you can, in the same way you can start watching a soap. You know, if you wanted to watch 20 years of Coronation Street to understand everything, you can. But in theory, you can just watch, as you say, the bit that you're watching, and it should make sense to some degree. And I would say it's the same, you know, with extended media. I don't think it should be decanonized. I don't think audiences should expect extended media, and certainly even the old show, to hold some sort of regimental control over new stories. Because I think you're right. I think that therefore becomes constrictive and you can't do anything new. So I think there's a bit of a give and take for me, is that, yeah, I mean, you can say, I mean, Moffat's acknowledged characters in the new show, sorry, in the Big Finish. Yeah. Russell T. Davis acknowledged the new adventures in his original treatments. I like to think that extended universe is probably all part of it. It's all BBC. It's all brought out. You've got all the original actors. But at the same time, I also feel that you can't expect the show to adhere to that, to those continuities.
See, with me, the books, the dramas, the radio dramas, the comics, they are all extended continuity. They're things that if you read them, you can believe whatever you want from them. That's fine. They're not required. They can be the past history. They can maybe not. I mean, when you think about it, the books contradict the audio dramas, and the audio drama is the same. So how can they all be true, basically, is the main thing. But for the Eighth Doctor mentioning his audio drama companions, or even Russell mentioning the new adventure books, it doesn't mean that you must then go watch those things or understand those things. All you need to understand in that moment is that the Eighth Doctor had friends by those names that he's referencing. If you listen to those audio dramas, then you know exactly what he's talking about. If you didn't, you know that he has people that he missed. That's all that's important in there. And that's why those radio dramas are not required viewing to understand what's happening right there for that Eighth Doctor. And that's what I'm talking about. If you get to a point where you sit there and you say that, like, you know, the War Doctor had a companion, and you need to understand this to understand that Christopher Eccleston must have traveled by himself for quite a long while alone just so that he had that moment there at the end with Rose, then that doesn't make any sense. You're forcing the audience to understand something from the books. Whereas if you just leave that to the audience to read a book on their own, then they can draw their own conclusions on that. But based on what we're seeing within the TV show right now, we do believe that Eccleston has been on his own somehow, some way, either this regeneration or the prior one. We don't need any more information than that. And if you then say that you must have this from the book, that's a problem, because most people aren't going to know that from the book. They're not going to go read the book.
I don't think you need to have it, but to be fair to the books, I mean, he was alive for decades because he came from very young to very old. To have, you know, even a year with a companion doesn't really take away from the fact that he was, by and large, someone who didn't deal with companions. Surely the same with Batman, isn't he? You know, Batman's a loner, but he will deal with the Justice League. But you wouldn't say that means that he is someone who isn't a loner. So you could argue it that way. If it doesn't totally change the direction, I think, you know, I'm not sure. To me, there's an issue, but that's obviously where I stand. Christian's very, very quiet, sitting on the fence as usual.
No, I'm fascinated by the discussion, really. I have very little to add to it. I just, it's all Doctor Who, or it's all not Doctor Who.
I'll be honest and say, when Star Wars came out with The Force Awakens, and they said that all the past books and comics and all that were no longer in continuity, I thought that was a pretty bold move. And I know it ticked off people, but I thought it was clever, because that freed you to tell brand new stories without being tied to this past that everybody knew so well. So therefore, if you were going to tell stories set in an era that a book has already touched on, well, then you have so much continuity that you have to adhere to, and you have to take your stories in a certain direction or deal with characters where they're left in the book. Like, you wouldn't have Chewbacca in the new movie, for example. I thought that was brilliant. And I think that's what the TV show should do. But rather than, like, Doctor Who did it differently, and I was actually just having this discussion online with somebody the other day. where I appreciate what Star Wars did, I like Doctor Who's approach, where they don't tell you that the books and the comics and the audios are not in continuity. They're all invalid now. They just say, hey, you want to believe them, believe them. If you don't, well, all you need is the TV show. And they handled it well like that, because when Russell rebooted this show, even though there's 26 years of history, he knew that there are people out there, and there are still people out there watching this new show all the way up through Moffat's era, who have not checked out the classic series yet, let alone books, radio dramas, or comics. And I think that's what's great about it, the fact that you have the freedom of choice to believe what past you want to believe, whereas with Star Wars, they took it away, which I still think is also a bold and wise move for them. I like the direction here that none of it is necessary. It's you can believe it if you want, but none of it is necessary, and I think that's great.
Okay.
Absolutely. I was just, you know, we could go on backwards and forth on this for ages, so I thought I will let that lie there. Though I am discounting Brian Terranova from my continuity.
You've been decanonized, Brian.
You've been decanonized.
I will be edited out of
You'll
this
be edited
podcast.
Out. Absolutely.
All past podcasts, it's just me and James or me.
Absolutely. Well, of course it's always just us two. Who are you talking about?
Okay. But you see, you couldn't do that, though, because I was in the TV show. You couldn't edit me out. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Special
Something happens in a TV
friend.
Show, you can't edit it out. But
Greedo
if it happens in a
first.
Book, you can if you don't want to use it again.
Greedo now shot first. It's official. Han Solo
trolls. Terranova shot first.
I. Who?
Terasolo shot first.
Terra Solo. Oh, I see now. I see where you're going now. You needed to actually make that.
Sorry.
Terra Solo to make the joke work, which is one of his handles to people who don't understand.
You know, it's actually funny because as we're doing this podcast, the entire time I've been staring at a box. And in that box is my finished replica of Han Solo's DL-44 blaster from Star Wars A New Hope. So it's funny that you guys would bring this all back there, and I've just been waiting to open this.
If we had Tom Baker on the podcast, he said, I've been staring at this box, and in this box, well, actually, it's my coffin.
He would, wouldn't he?
He absolutely would. So there you go. So one of those moments where you wish you had a Tom Baker voice impersonator. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast with a K. Big thanks to Brian Terranova and James McLean. I'm Christian Corley. Until next time, it's goodbye. Does anyone want to do the intro, or shall I do the intro?
Knock yourself out.
Absolutely.
Well, then one of you will have to do the intro.
Oh! Hey!
Oh, I'm so warm this evening. It's not true.